Blog Talk Radio. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear. I'm Susan Laris and Dans, and I'm joined again on this Saturday night for a very relaxed conversation by my partner, Brian Ressler. Welcome, Brian.
Hi, Susan. Hi, everybody in the chat.
Tonight, we're going to explore a topic that I think many of us have been pondering for quite some time, this concept of freedom and what does freedom mean to us, and are we truly free in our lives in every possible way, from the workplace to our spiritual life to the countries that we live in every possible way. What does freedom mean to us, and how do we discover freedom? And is that our goal as well? For tonight's show, we do welcome perspectives from the people listening. We're not here to give a monologue tonight. We really do welcome callers to the show and people in the chat. The call-in number, and we already have a caller waiting, and I do see you there. The call-in number is 310-807-5104. And we do have a chat room that is open tonight to comment in the chat. If you're new to Blog Talk Radio, you do need to get an ID, which is quite simple. And at times, we hope to share some of the conversation going on in the chat. So I think I'm going to start this off just by saying that for me, freedom has been a progression. It is something where I think there were many times in my life where I thought I was freer than I actually was. And I think that we are often trained in our society to be in situations where our freedom is encumbered much more than it needs to be. I'll give one simple example is in the workplace, is that a lot of us in the workplace are in situations where we really don't have empowerment, depending on what the leadership is like within an organization. And that was one way, and we are trained to just accept that. And yet, when you work for someone who is more open-minded in the workplace, you discover what it's like to truly participate in what you're creating as opposed to a more authoritarian structure. So that's certainly one way. Another way that I know that I was not free was certainly within my spiritual life, because I was taught a number of things that were very fear-based. And this show has a recurring theme about fear. And when we're in fear, can we really experience a sense of empowerment and freedom? So these are things that, you know, we'll explore throughout the night. And I'm going to bring Brian in here for a minute so that he can talk a little bit about his perspectives on freedom. Is it a goal? Where is he in his... So, Brian, where are you in your life with respect to freedom? How do you view this?
Oh, gee, freedom. Here in the United States, land of the free, home of the brave. From my perspective, freedom is a combination of two things. It's a state of mind, and it's also a state of tolerance. In that, are you free if you think you're free? And there are quite a few people who feel that they're free, and they're really not. So this is sort of the gilded cage scenario. And most people don't realize they're not free until they actually go to do something and find out that they're not. That would be the shackle on your leg that you never noticed until you tried to go where you weren't supposed to. And examples of that are all over the place. You just have to go back a little bit in time. People not free to marry for any number of reasons. It's a very common one. And even still today, you can have issues. Matter of fact, I'm forgetting the very large issue of freedom to marry who you wish to marry. There are people who will define and say that marriage is between a man and a woman only, thus eliminating, you know, 10% of the population from being married. Go back further in time, go back 40 years, 50 years, and, you know, well, you know, that person is of a different race, you can't marry them. You know, go further back, that person is of a different religion. So freedoms, very simple freedoms, just to marry, follow your heart. Freedom to follow your heart is essentially what I'm talking about, has been getting better. You know, you're a little freer, a little freer. You know, marrying outside of religion at one time was, you know, never considered. Marrying outside of race, you know, that was never considered. At some point, we'll get to where, you know, you're actually free to do what you truly want to do, as long as it doesn't infringe upon others. There are freedoms that, I guess that's the other side of it I'm looking at, is there's my freedom, but also my freedom to be free, but also my freedom to be free of other people's freedoms. That is, to be free of what other people try to impose upon me. If people have a certain belief that I'm not allowed to work on Saturday, okay, that's their belief, but if they impose it upon me, then I'm no longer free to do as I choose on a Saturday. Little things like that actually exist in some countries. So freedom to do what we choose and freedom from what others want to choose us to do. That's how I look at freedom.
You know, one of the first things you mentioned, Brian, was how some people have this perception of being free when they really aren't. And what's also interesting about that is that from my own experience, often you can be pretty happy. It's kind of like being a slave in the palace. If you don't know that you're a slave and you think that, you know, you are free, and you don't even, you're taught not to test those boundaries. See, that's the other thing, is if you're taught not to test the boundaries, then you can have this perception of being free when indeed you are not. And then the other thing that I was thinking about as you were talking is, last week I was listening to a conservative talk show host who was talking about the legalization of marijuana, for example, and how to him that would be an infringement on his life, even if he would never do it, but because if someone, his perception was that people doing that might infringe on him in some way by being out of control or whatever. Now, of course, this person didn't talk about how that happens with alcohol and things like that, but even so, what was interesting that I got out of that was how what some people would view as a freedom issue, and there are many different points of view on this particular topic, to him it was an infringement to allow that degree of freedom in society. And of course, if you take that to an extreme, from his perception, there were rules. There are rules that you have to follow in society, and, you know, we are not free because of a perception of God-given rules. And so I think that freedom is very much in the eye of the beholder. And yet when someone feels that those boundaries are too tight for them and they're not harming someone else and they are being responsible with whatever the situation is, I could bring up other topics such as women's rights and how people are establishing rules and having a real influence on society that are impacting women because of a religious viewpoint that isn't shared by everyone. And so that would be infringing on someone's freedom, and yet they have a perception that it would infringe on other things if that freedom is available. So I think perception is so important in this. And we are getting some callers. Welcome to the Frontier Beyond Fear. You're on the air.
Hi, is that me?
Yes, it's you.
My name is Hugh, and I'm calling from Virginia, and I'm very interested in the show because I'm standing in my truth, and I've had bizarre experiences throughout my entire life that I've learned from, and I have no more fear. I've had paranormal near-death and UFO experiences, and I have things that I'm now trying to show people that we all have unlimited creativity, but we don't realize it because we're under some kind of an authority since birth. However, in our quiet times and with existing technologies, we can very quickly transform our lives in ways that are collaborative, and that's what we should be doing anyway. And there's a powerful little poem I dedicated to my wife. That poem is also in the President Ronald Reagan Library. It's discussed as a weapon against terrorism, and currently I'm using it to help the people of Haiti who can't help themselves. The poem's only 3 lines long. It's titled Caring, Sharing, and it reads, "If you dare to care, then share. If you share, pay heed. God will reward every good deed." It sort of sums up what life should be all about.
Well, thank you, Hugh, for sharing that. And we will talk to you again sometime.
Okay, thank you.
So, Brian, I assume you're still with us here. What are your perspectives on what can we do if we feel that our leadership is not being responsive to our needs? What are the solutions? Because it seems to me, as I look at society, that there are a lot of shared goals, both on, you know, the liberal side of things and on the right, because I listen to all different perspectives. And, you know, what can we do?
Well, you look at politicians, and you have to remember that they are, in fact, elected. And, you know, to be elected requires a lot of money. So with the recent changes in the election laws, thank you, the conservative right-wing politicians and lobbyists who've done that, now businesses can give as much money to they want as they want to any candidate, even if it's not related to anything. And we saw that in the last round of elections where businesses actually got vengeful with political candidates and went out and basically gave money to the other side, even though they didn't agree with him, just to make the person they were upset with, for whatever reasons, struggle in the elections. So there's two things you can do there. One is you can hold the politicians accountable, which is one thing they never want to do. That's why they never come out with an opinion or a point. They always weasel on everything. And I am speaking in generalities here. There are politicians who don't weasel, but most of them do. You ask them a direct question, and they never give you a direct answer. This way you can't hold them accountable. And that's the trick. Hold them accountable. If they promise something, and you have to be careful because they'll promise a lot of things, but if they promise something big and make no effort to implement it, bring it up. Hold them accountable. Go to those town meetings and in their face, in front of cameras, ask the questions. In the modern age, in the internet age, Twitter age, social media, things can happen lightning. You know, a week ago, more than that. Yeah, it was about a week ago. Call it 8 or 9 days ago, Donald Trump was, you know, the leading presidential contender with 40% majority, you know, blah, blah, blah. A week later, he's last week's news. He's falling rapidly in the polls. Nobody likes him. He has pretty much no chance of getting the nomination should he choose to run. So just that quickly, somebody who's popular can become unpopular. There are candidates, candidates for president who have gone out there and done something as silly as a weird whoop sound in front of cameras, and suddenly their ratings fall 20 or 30%. American voters can be fickle. They can swing with the wind, but you can also put something in front of them and say, are you willing to accept this? this is what this person believes, really believes. Are you willing to accept that from this person? Because you agree with most of what they do, or all of what they do, none of what they do. Now, let's be honest. How many of us vote for the candidate we think will do the least damage? You go to the polls, you look at the Democratic candidate, you look at the Republican candidate, you look at a third couple of third-party candidates, and you decide which one will cause the least harm and vote for that one. You know, should we pass a referendum? We live in Oregon. We have a referendum system. We could pass a referendum that says none of the above. And if none of the above gets 51%, nobody gets elected, or you have to go to a new election. I think that would be great. We have none of the above. Let your voices be heard. I mean, really heard, and be serious about it. You can do it electronically. You can get out there. You can let people know what you think, and speak your mind and see what happens.
You know, I have to say that in some ways, I've become so disillusioned with the current system and how powerful the influences are within the system that I honestly feel that the only solution is on a spiritual level, you know, as a spiritual person, that we have to get to a higher level of consciousness so that we're beyond this mentality of taking advantage of one another and of always, you know, at the base of it to me, it's always survival mode of one form or another. And that's what leads to greed. And it's selfishness. And we need to get to a higher level of consciousness. So in a way, when I think about solutions that are at just the level that we're used to dealing with and have been dealing with for so many centuries, it just doesn't feel satisfying to me. It just doesn't seem to be enough. We need to trust that things are going to shift. And this show is a lot about that. Since this is in the spirituality category, even though tonight we're covering a lot of different issues in current events, but spirituality touches everything in my mind. So, and this isn't about forcing someone to believe a spiritual way either. This is about a quantum leap in thinking about how we go about our lives, and that's sort of what I'm heading towards in terms of a solution. I'm going to bring another caller. Oh, go right ahead.
Let me backtrack real quick. Let me go back to something you said, and you talked about costs and expenses. The colloquial we, got Osama bin Laden this week, or the end of last week, and there was cheering in the streets. And people were jumping up and down. The news agencies were showing this. And everybody was happy. And I'd like to point out a couple things about this. One, cheering the death of any person is never a good thing. I was kind of appalled at part of it. Let's talk about the cost of Osama bin Laden. Let's talk about, and this is going back, this, we're talking about holding our politicians to feet to the fire on this one. You know, Congress voted, and who can remember the one person that abstained from, you know, the resolutions that came out of 9/11? Nobody remembers that person. Nobody remembers the Dixie Chicks saying they were sorry they were from Texas, you know. The cost of getting Osama bin Laden, the boogeyman, the scary guy, the mastermind that defeated the United States, the cost in U.S. dollars was $3 trillion. Okay, that's a lot of money. 920,000 lives were involved in the cost of Osama bin Laden. 920,000 lives. The Iraq and the Afghan wars. 920,000 dead. Predominantly civilians. 1.7 million injured people in those wars. 1.7 million. An additional 250,000 estimated U.S. injuries that have yet to fully come to light. These are combat shock troops that are just now recognizing there's a problem. That was the cost of Osama bin Laden. What would the price have been to prevent this? What would the price have been to undo what we were doing that caused him to be angry enough to do what he did? you know, this is, we're talking about compassion here. Is it easier to reach out a hand and assist somebody, or is it easier to pontificate and reach for a stick and hit them because they can hit back? The answer to that was a political one. It was a political choice, and it was U.S. policy of where nobody held the people who did it responsible for it. That $3 trillion, that is 920,000 dead people, 1.7 million injured people, that goes back to the choices we made, and we didn't hold anybody accountable for them. Ultimately, I believe people in the U.S. are responsible for that because we said, well, you know, we'll elect somebody and let them take care of it. This is what I'm talking about. If you want to be responsible for yourself and have your own freedoms, then you have to make that more than just about you. You know, you can't step back and just allow this to happen. It's one of those things you have to step back and look at now and say, here's the lesson. What have we learned from this besides the expense? What have we learned in the future going forward? So we reach out and offer assistance, so should we hold a stick and shake it at somebody?
Well, now, my view of this, again, is we have to handle these. We cannot stay in the current level of consciousness. I think it was Albert Einstein, I don't have the exact quote, that says it. You must solve a problem in a different level of consciousness in which it was created. And to me, this continual cycle of vengeance that's going on, that's been going on for centuries and centuries, really, since, you know, the latest round of the human race has been around, if we don't break out of that, if we were not to rise to a higher consciousness, I fully believe that we would destroy ourselves because we're fully capable of doing that now. Now, as a spiritual person, I have faith that that isn't going to happen. But in that lower level of, you know, what got me about the celebration and even references to like punting the football and things, because one of the first things I thought, it was like we're in some kind of football game here, you know, and we're cheering, you know, because our side scored. And you know what? That's not what it's about. And it may have been about that in the past, but there were a lot of people in the spiritual community who were also appalled. You used that word, being appalled. And that word was going around last week because many people were really upset about the reaction. And that's because we see beyond the back and forth warlike behavior that's been going on in society for so long, because we know that that kind of behavior is never going to solve any of our problems. It is never going to solve anything. It always leads to more wars. You know, if you look at history, a lot of times one war leads to another. World War II eventually ended up, or World War I eventually ended up causing World War II. And, you know, we are at a level of technology now where we can't afford that. But there's a problem in that our societies are making a lot of money. A lot of people are employed by the business of war. And one of the things I observed, I don't know, I guess it was a few weeks ago, was there was a rise in unemployment. And then it was reported that there were some jobs cut in the defense sector. And that really got me thinking because I thought, wow, you know, there are so many jobs, so much manufacturing going on within that sector. We're dependent on war to keep our economy afloat. And that's a real trap. My feeling about all of this is that if we don't evolve as a species, we're not going to get past this time in our history. Eventually, it's going to get really rough. And, you know, I feel like some of the things that are going on right now may be pushing us towards that. But I can't see any conventional solution to these problems. What would you have to say to that, Brian?
The traditional, if you can't see a solution to the, you said traditional solution to the problem, then we have to look at non-traditional solutions. But we have to step back from the problem and see if what we're working on needs work. The military term is boondoggle, where you put a lot of effort into something that either doesn't matter or you can't really change. So step back from the problem and look at the underlying issue. Are we trying to treat a symptom? Are we trying to treat an underlying cause? I think a lot of the problems we've been doing the same things for so long. Take education. Education hasn't changed in, 120 years. The way we teach children, does that mean it works? No, but it means everybody knows how to do it. And they keep doing it the same way because that's the way they've always done it. Does it make it right? Does it make it efficient? Is it even going to make it work? So sometimes you have to throw out everything and start from scratch. Absolutely take a step back, and instead of trying to work on that problem that everybody's working on, look at the whole thing in total and say, what is it we really want? What is it we're really trying to achieve? And what's the simplest way to do that? Sometimes it can be very, very simple things. And sometimes a little bit of money and some apologies and some effort, and boom, things are fixed. Look at Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland's at peace. Northern Ireland had an election on Thursday, and the two sides that have been at war for years are running the coalition government, and there's still peace. There's still a little bit of rocks, a little bit of bumps. There's a lot of stuff under the surface, but they're looking at the economy saying, look, if Ireland's going to survive, we need to come to terms and work it out. That's what I'm talking about.
That's a perfect example. And what has caused them, you know, you have to wonder, what is behind the scenes allowing them to find that cooperative spirit? And I guess that's where my faith lies, is that we are evolving, that we are finding ways. There are things available to us right now that may not have been available to us before as easily. There have always been way showers in our society. There's no doubt about that. But what happens when more and more people find that level of consciousness that the way showers found long ago? And that's what you see going on when people look for ways to collaborate. You know, I haven't heard much about it recently, but for a while there was an initiative to create a Department of Peace. And there are actually very active people advocating for peace, many well-known people, who what they're advocating for is diffusing conflict. That we don't, when we take an aggressive model towards conflict, when we view it like some kind of football game, you know, when we deal with everything at a visceral level instead of a higher level where you intelligently think about what are the consequences of every action, because when you're going back and forth like this, as you said a little bit ago, Brian, you know, there are consequences to that. And, you know, you cannot just think out the next move. And we're not even talking a strategic chess game either, because a lot of people view it that coldly. It's not like that. You have to think about the overall goals of where we're heading and what will result in a peaceful resolution. And unfortunately, I think the world has gotten to a state where there are many people who want war. And some of those people are corporate interests who are dependent on war. And in many ways, our economy is dependent. I was listening to a talk show one day, and he was quoting Eisenhower, and how Eisenhower thought the military-industrial complex was very dangerous. And we've become very dependent on that structure within our society, and that's a problem.
Well,
because, yes.
Of that $3 trillion we spent on the war on terror, you know, approximately $2 trillion of that was not for salaries or troop expenses per se, but basically went somewhere into the military-industrial complex over a 10-year span. That breaks out to $1 billion working day. That's some real money. And if you're making, if you're in the business that makes $1 billion a day, and there's a fairly good profit margin on those products, you can afford to you know, make contributions here or there and pay lobbyists.
Well, and the lobby is very strong. There's no question about that. And what I find so very sad is that when you look at these budget talks, no one wants to touch the military budget because, you know, it's keeping us safe. And I get what they're where they're coming from. I do. I mean, I do believe there are many people who believe we genuinely need that to keep us safe. But we are going to destroy the entire our entire society, our social fabric. There won't be anything left to preserve. There are people, you know, there's so many people who just don't acknowledge what's going on with people who, for example, don't have health insurance. Those people are dying. Many of those people are dying. And many more people are dying from that than from terrorist acts. And yet we're not paying attention to that. And until we have the insight and the compassion and the wisdom to deal with the things that actually allow a society to perpetuate, and that is not war, we're not going to solve this problem. And, of course, we've got the other problem in that our freedoms are being more and more infringed. You know, the more that we need to keep us safe, the less free we all are. And that's a real catch-22. And I know there are a lot of people who will say that it's very intentional, that there are people who wish us ill and want to keep us and in a disempowered state and even disempower us more. And I suppose that can be true. There are people like that out there. But I have to say, I think there are a lot of people in our leadership who are reasonable people and who don't want that. But I think they're being influenced by some very powerful forces that are controlling our society. I do think that is happening. And the only way we're going to get beyond this, once again, to me, is we have to get to a higher level of consciousness, which means people will awaken, even those who are not acting in the best interests of society, they too will begin to awaken. And that will solve our problems. If not for that, if I didn't believe in that, I would have absolutely no hope whatsoever in the current world. I would say that we were like the Roman Empire. You know, the Roman Empire was highly militarized at the end, and people were losing their rights in the end. And I would say that we are going down, and actually the whole world would be in trouble. But I do have faith that we're going to get to that higher level of consciousness, which will allow us not only to continue on as a species, but to thrive and to evolve.
I agree. The you talk about the United States. They estimate it can be somewhere around 2012, somewhere 2013, the Chinese economy will overtake the U.S. economy. The Chinese economy is growing. The U.S. economy is not. We've shipped all our jobs overseas. We don't make anything anymore. We can't really do much. If you studied your history, the United States looks a lot like Great Britain did in 1945. And if you remember your history, Great Britain pretty much let all the colonies go in 47 and fell apart. So, you know, we always talk about what a great nation we are. I think we do a lot of way showing, but I think we've gotten lost somewhere along the way. We've kind of forgotten, you know, where we should be heading, and we're just kind of meandering about. I think we need a couple of coincidences and a couple of shocks to nudge us in the right direction, and I'd be really interested just how those are going to occur.
Well, I think that at a spiritual level, there are things that will likely occur. They will not be at a conventional level. I mean, I think that there is a spiritual shift taking place. And I also think that a lot of the darkness that we see in the world right now is helping to bring that shift about. A friend of mine just tonight wrote to me about a dark night of the soul. And I have this feeling that our culture is going through a dark night of the soul. Many of the people who are unemployed, many of the people who actually don't know the solution to the threats that are out there, who don't know the solution to even the way our infrastructure is crumbling in the United States. And, you know, some of these other societies that seem to be doing well, like China, well, what are they built upon? I mean, they're built upon something very insubstantial because they're not, you know, they're polluting the environment, they're disempowering people all over the place. I mean, that is not sustainable either. And so I feel that there's probably quite a few people, even in our leadership, who are feeling hopeless. I really do feel that way. They won't share that with us, I'm sure. And they don't want the general public to feel that way because to them it would cause us to go down even faster. The economy would plummet, people would take their money out of the stock market or whatever. However, I do sense that there is a great hopelessness out there, and it is like a collective dark night of the soul. And I have to say that many of us who have been through personal dark nights of the soul and have found a spiritual anchor, we don't feel it as severely as others. I think you feel somewhat, you do feel it. I mean, I'm not saying I'm totally immune to feeling the troubles in society, but it's not the same because I have faith. And I think that many people have faith of different kinds, whether they're a Christian, whether they're of a more New Age persuasion, even, you know, within other cultures. I've been hearing a lot about within Islam, how they're looking forward to a shift of their own, a spiritual awakening of their own. Now, many people demonize that and view it in a divisive way. But the thing is that they, too, believe that a time of harmony is coming in their own way. And that is becoming more and more common among different, diverse spiritual paths. And that is where I place my hope.
I agree. If you've been through certain changes or certain shifts yourself, when you see those shifts in others, there's more of an understanding or more of a compassion. You also know to step back and allow it to occur. Some things I see going on in the world, it's a microcosm of things that have gone on elsewhere. It's occurred before. You know, there's the old adage, those who forget history are doomed to repeat it. Well, if you watch somebody work through something through history, you can take advantage of that lesson and look at it and say, you know, this has occurred here and it's occurred here and it's occurred here. I don't have to repeat that in order to learn this lesson. I don't have to pay the cost. I can take advantage of somebody else having gone through that lesson and just touch upon it, but not actually have to endure it. Of course, that begs the question, what about those who rewrite history? Or what about those who deny history? What happens to them? What lessons do they have to go through when they're not paying attention?
Well, as they say, are they doomed to repeat it? because... You know, sometimes you feel like there is a form of societal karma, in a sense, that societies are going through the same lessons over and over. Collectively, we've chosen to learn similar lessons. And, you know, I do believe that there have been other times on the earth when other human races have reached their demise, and even way before our known history. I think more and more we're going to find that there have been other cultures on the earth that have ended and maybe just a remnant survived. And do I believe that's going to happen again? I really don't. I think this time we're going to make it. I mean, I think there may be some turbulence along the way, but I think we're going to make it this time because I think that we're finally going to raise our consciousness. And, you know, we're not alone in doing this. I have to say, although I respect what everyone believes, I do, my compassion really goes out to people who do not have spiritual anchors right now, whatever that anchor might be. And I know there are people who don't like any kind of spiritual or religious path, and I completely respect that. But I would have a really hard time myself if not for faith right now. That's the way I feel.
Well, I have a different interpretation of faith. That's a whole different show. We're getting into the meaning of words here. But I have a, where most people use faith, I would put more of a gnosis a feeling within that it will work out, that things are correct, that sometimes I just need to be a little more patient and allow things to work their course. Some people can make changes very, very quickly. Other people a little longer. Some people have to have a 27-step plan and a checkbox and validation of every step before they move forward. And every one of those is a valid path. But one path makes some people uncomfortable, and the other makes some people impatient. So you just have to allow.
Well, I know that depending on what path you're pursuing, sometimes doubt on that path can hold you back as much as having no path at all. Actually, it's essentially the equivalent. And I've come to believe that part of this consciousness shift that we're going through is going to enable us to find faith. I know that within my own path, there were times in my life, and certainly even now this happens, where faith eluded me. And it wasn't just because of the particular theology, or it wasn't just that. It wasn't just dogmatic. I just had trust issues. And I think many of us are like wounded children right now. And we've not found the answers that we seek. The society around us is seeming rather bleak right now. Many people don't believe the reports that the economy is recovering. You know, I wish our leaders respected us a little bit more, respected our intelligence. But unfortunately, a lot of people are just asleep and don't see through it, because I feel like so many of the messages that are sent out are just to calm the populace. That's it. And it doesn't matter whether those messages are true or false. And, you know, when you're not getting accurate information, that is definitely a form of someone disempowering you. If your leaders cannot share the truth with you, that is disempowering. And even if they think that they're protecting a society, ultimately, withholding truth will destroy a society. It may take a while, but there is no trust in that kind of society. I mean, the old little saying, oh, what a tangled web we weave, regarding deception, it really does have meaning. And what ends up happening is ultimately, not only do the people feel that they're not free, they have no trust in what they're hearing. And so then you can't tell them anything. I mean, if it gets to a point where there's no trust whatsoever, those messages are going to become meaningless. And, you know, I have to say I've had a bit of an awakening to that just in the last couple months, where it's just becoming so obvious to me that no matter what channel I turn on the news, whether it's MSNBC or Fox, there is deception on both. It's a different flavor of deception, but it is deception. And that is disempowering me. That disempowers all of us. If people have an agenda and they can't be upfront, and I feel that, you know, there's messaging going on where there are things that they've been told to get out. I mean, I don't know what's going on behind the scenes, but whatever it is, it has nothing to do with freedom or a positive future for the people. And I think that's a real problem. And, you know, many people have said that when consciousness expands, we will become more telepathic. And what's so interesting about that is that'll be the end of the era of lies. It won't be possible to lie anymore. And that would be the most dramatic thing that could ever happen to us as a species.
I think you've hit on something interesting here. We talk about transition of the human race. And everybody, well, at least a lot of people I've talked to, always assume it's going to be like turning on a light switch. You're going to go click and everything shifts. And I've always felt that that's not going to happen. I've always been in the opinion it's going to be more of a gradual thing. This is not the best example, but it's funny. a herd of cattle crossing a river. One cow has to go in first, and one cow has to go in last. And at some point, there might be some on each bank. There might be some in the river. It might be one or two who get swept downstream. There's always a couple cowboys there to help. But eventually, they all cross the river in their own good time. If you go to some countries, they actually swim them across lakes or across fjords. I mean, they're over their head in spots. So if you take that into the shift in human consciousness, at some point there's going to be those that have shifted. And they can't really, you can't really lie to them. Try lying to a four-year-old, it just doesn't work. So you're going to have that portion that sees the lie for what it is. You're going to have those in transition that have trouble with what's being said. They may not know why, but they have trouble with it. It troubles them. And then you'll have those on the other bank that haven't left yet and think it's perfectly fine. Well, the government's telling you the government has your best interest in there for you, and that's what they're going to do. They've obviously haven't read their history. The government historically always lies. It's an institutional thing. I mean, go back and look wherever you want. Look at, during World War II, it lied constantly about this or that. It lied about the Soviets. I mean, you can go into the Freedom of Information Act and look at all kinds of stuff that they would tell you, and you know it's a lie. But you took it at face value because, well, it's the government. They must know what they're doing. So it's just one of those things it does. Either they lie or they omit things. That's not really a lie. They just don't tell you what you really wanted to hear, or they do the old not answer the question kind of thing. So as we raise our consciousness, that's not going to work anymore. People are going to accept it less and less. And I think this is what the Arab Spring is all about. You're seeing, you look at Syria. Syria says, oh, we pulled the troops out. And people are like, sending courier pigeons out saying, no, they're all still here. I know they said they left, but they really haven't. And these leaders don't know what to do. I mean, they've always done it. You just lie. You suppress the press. You filter the internet, you shut off the cell phones, you shut off the text messages, and then you do what you want because, who's going to dispute you? But it's not working anymore, is it? So in the face of an evolving civilization, lies won't be possible. When lies are no longer possible, you have to face the issues, you have to face the problem and deal with it. You can't just say, oh, yeah, we're going to fix it, and then never do. You have to because it's obvious and everybody can see it.
I wrote a short story once where it actually had to do with 2012, and it was quite a while ago that I wrote it. But at the end of the story, people become telepathic after facing this crisis. And how did that telepathy take form? It wasn't even in the details of someone else's thoughts. It was in finally understanding your enemy, your so-called enemy, that you actually could get inside their head and you could see what they'd seen. You could see the truth about why they felt that you were their enemy. And just through understanding that, we found peace. And I feel like if telepathy, and I do believe it is on the horizon, I mean, a form of it exists already. I mean, whenever you think of a friend and then they call you, that's telepathy. So I do believe it's within our grasp. And how it would impact society would be, I really believe it would be more dramatic than just about anything that could happen. And, as far as people lying to us, a lot of people view us like children. I mean, they mean well. As much as I would like to demonize everybody, and there are leaders that do not have the best interests of society in mind, and I'm not saying all leaders are like that, but I think that there are many leaders who do feel they have the best interests of society in mind, and so they have this paternalistic view like a parent. Like, you can't tell your child everything, or that could cause trouble. Or even that they wouldn't understand because they wouldn't know all the details and they would just overreact and that would cause chaos. And so I understand how we've gotten to this point, even in the most well-meaning of societies. Even if you don't want to demonize anyone, and there's a lot of demonization going around these days. But the fact of the matter is, until we get to a level of trust, there's going to be a problem. And, you know, I think there's a lot of distrust. I think there's increasing fear. I think that when people feel that their freedoms are being infringed upon, they're afraid to speak even. Even on a show like this where, you know, we're not saying anything wrong. We're just talking about very conventional things. And yet people have become afraid, and that's not freedom. It saddens me to see that we're losing freedoms. We're going the wrong direction right now, and yet I still have hope, as I say, that it's going to bounce back. It's like a big bungee cord. We're being stretched way out to this dark place, and it's a dark night of the soul for our culture, and then we're going to bounce back. And when we do, it's going to be a miracle, and it's going to be the thing that everybody's been looking for, and yet for probably everyone, it'll come about differently than they expect. And yet when you share in that higher consciousness, suddenly you'll understand. I don't claim to know all the answers about what's going to happen, but I bet when it does happen, because we're not just going to be sharing in our consciousness of each other, we're talking higher consciousness, the Creator's consciousness, all that is, we are going to have a glimpse into that, which will answer so many questions and will take us to a higher level finally. And so what's been predicted by so many different religious groups and even cultures, going back to the Mayans, they predict very miraculous things happening in this time frame. It's the end of an age, but it's the beginning of a much better one. And so I have faith that that's where we're heading. I just wanted to say, since we're at the hour mark of this show, we won't necessarily go on all night. We do welcome calls if anyone would like to call who hasn't called in already. And that number is 310-807-5104. But we'll keep this going as long as it makes sense. It's just an open conversation tonight.
I had to double check the phone number. I thought it was 301. And it is 310.
Yeah, 310. I might have typed it wrong in the chat room. I'm not sure. But anyway, if anyone who hasn't called in yet tonight would like to call, feel free to do so. So, Brian, I guess, I'd like... Let's talk a little bit more about what has been predicted for this time and the cycles, and what is your view of this? And also, how does it? I know you're knowledgeable about ancient cultures, and we'll get into some real, you know, what we like to call woo-woo stuff or whatever, fringe stuff. You know, talk about, you know, previous cultures on this earth, like Lemuria or Atlantis. And what does that have to do with us in this time?
Well, let's go quite that far back. Let's talk about the Mayans. That's a big one coming up right now because, of course, there's about 20 different specials on the Discovery Networks and lots of books and lots of lectures and everything. And to set the record straight, the Mayans did not predict the end of the world. I happen to know that the end of the world will occur on January 31st of 2012, because the calendar I'm holding, that's the last month on it. And since the calendar ends, the world must end then too. So along those lines, the Mayans actually had started making a new calendar. Their calendars are just really, really long. So when you make a calendar that's 5,000 years long, it takes a little bit of prep time. They hadn't finished it, but they had started on it. So what the Mayans really said was that the world is not going to end, but time is going to end. It's the end of time. And the Mayan calendar is based on cycles, and there's a number of cycles in there. And if you're a mathematician or an electrical engineer, it's actually a Fourier series. what that means is there's a bunch of sine waves, and they're different sizes. There's different distances between the peaks. And if you lay these on a graph paper, you have all these sine waves on there. And then you start to add them up. If you have three sine waves in one spot that peak, you get a really big peak. And if you have one sine wave that peaks where another one has a valley, you get zero. So you get this weird-looking thing that jumps up and down. And these cycles are very long. Some of them are thousands of years long. Some of them are hundreds and dozens and tens of years. They have all these different cycles. And basically what they said was the end of the cycle was going to occur roughly in 2012. If you actually do the math, I believe it occurred in 2004. The actual end of the cycle is roughly in 2004. I'm sorry, no, that's something else. We'll get to that in a second. End of the cycle is approximately in 2012. Where it crosses the galactic plane, you'll hear that the Earth is passing through this galactic plane. What it is the galaxy looks like a big ellipse, and there's a theoretical middle to it. And I say theoretical, if it's 100,000 light years across, where exactly is the middle? Because you're not exactly sure where the edges are. Well, with our best estimates of the Milky Way, where the middle of the Milky Way is and where we're passing through that, because we kind of bob like the moon does. Sometimes it's a little further north, sometimes it's a little further south. Where we're passing through that theoretical middle occurred in 1998, actually. So that occurred a while ago. Within best estimates. It's hard to say exactly because you have to come up with an arbitrary place of where the edges are. And when you look at the universe, and how we're looking through dust clouds, and we have to, you know, it doesn't just end, it just kind of fizzles out a little bit on the edges. So they were pretty close. Were they exact? Within their limits. You know, you have to ask the questions about the Mayans. You know, who were they? How spiritual were they? They have an observatory in there where they show eight planets. That's a phenomenal thing, because three of them you can't see without a telescope. They show moons on Jupiter, something you can't see without a telescope. They show four moons around Jupiter. So how did they have this knowledge long before Galileo had it, which means Galileo wasn't the first, and it's widely accepted. The planets orbiting the sun was widely held in other civilizations in the Americas as well. And without thought. So that belief that was more recently discovered, you know, by Galileo and Copernicus, that's only when it was rediscovered in Europe. So we talk about truth, we come back full circle again. Here's something people have always accepted as being the truth, but it's not. Other civilizations didn't hold that the sun was the center of the universe, just some of the ones that we've studied and are more famous. So the Mayans think it's a great joy. It's a time of renewal because all things come to an end, and it's a chance to start new. Think of it as the ultimate garage sale. You get to get rid of your baggage. You get to pick new stuff. So instead of fearing the change, I'm more of embracing the change. You know, we're going to let go of some of that baggage we've been dragging around for a long time. And depending on your views of the universe and recorded and unrecorded human history, 20, 30, 40,000 years worth of human history has gotten us to this point. And, you know, we were going down one path, and we made a sharp turn, and now we're going down a different path. A lot of people haven't updated their maps. They're still packed for the old path. They bought, you know, all their Armageddon clothes, and here we are going to sunny paradise, and they don't have any paradise clothes, so they're all grumpy about it. I think once we get there, and it's going to be a gradual thing, we're just going to kind of, it's like slipping into a bathtub. You just kind of slip in gradually. Once you get there, you won't really realize you're there till later. It's one of those things where you look back and say, oh, you know, I definitely wasn't here, but I was here. It occurred somewhere around here for me. It'll be a personal thing. There'll be people doing it in groups. There'll be nations doing it. But you'll see some shifts. You'll see things occur that nobody thought would occur, and you'll scratch your head and go, how did that happen? I mean, snap your fingers overnight, governments are gone, new governments are in there, peace deals come in, things you didn't think would ever occur just occur. People say, well, you know, we used to be enemies, now we're not. The U.S. used to you know, be at war with Japan, and yet Japan's one of our best allies and trading partners. And not that long ago. And it's like, you know, doesn't take long. You can forget and forgive, and off you go. And just have to do it on a bigger scale for the rest of the planet.
You know, I remember when the Berlin Wall came down, and I couldn't believe it. You know, as children, we were brought up with the Cold War, and it seemed like it would go on forever. And when that happened, it was like a miracle at the time. It was a substantial shift. And if something like that can happen, then we can transcend beyond the problems that we have now. I really do believe that. I think, as you said, Brian, it's as if you almost won't even know what's happening in terms of consciousness. I think that's the way it is when we shift personally in our consciousness. You have to kind of look back. You know, I look back on my own history, and even though I can't say I'm free from fear, I call this show The Frontier Beyond Fear, and maybe partially because this is a continuing battle for me throughout my life, having been quite a fearful person, especially when I was young. And I believe being free from fear is something that you live one moment at a time. And if you fail in one minute, you can always get it right the next. It's all about reactions. But anyway, I look back on who I was, and I can see a tremendous difference between who I used to be and who I am now. And somewhere along the line, I did experience a shift. Now, we have a question from the chat room. I do want to let people in the chat room know that you are most welcome to pose questions, and we'll involve you in this conversation. The question is, are people waking collectively, individually, from your perspective in your community, families, friends, coworkers? And I'll take that very briefly, and then I'll pass it on to Brian and say, to me, it's both. To me, it starts on the individual level, and then it grows and grows. And it's, you know, when I was a few years ago, I had a dream. It was a very dramatic dream, and it was about flowers blooming in a field. And I knew that it was symbolic of awakening. And at the beginning, it was like in the spring, this time of year, you know, just a few flowers open up here and there. But then before you know it, the whole field is in bloom. And to me, that's what awakening is like. Every individual flower is opening up in its own way, but together it forms the field of consciousness. And we are coming into bloom one by one, and before we know it, it's just going to take root with everyone. That's my hope. Some people say that not everyone will awaken. There are theories within the metaphysical community that some people will be left behind, and you see that in different ways. You see that in the Christian community in a different way, but you also see that within New Age communities. I tend to not accept those views, because I think that when consciousness shifts, it will be available to everyone. It's just that some people are late bloomers, so to speak. So anyway, I'll let Brian answer your question too.
I think that it always starts with individuals. There are always some way showers out there. There are always people who are trying it. And if you go back and look historically, I think there's a lot of rich religions built around some of these people. Some very enlightened individuals have certain perceptions in certain ways, and people held them up as divine. And while they're divine, they're no more or less divine than the rest of us. They just happen to be in a slightly more enlightened state. And once those individuals become a little more common, it's like a seeding effect. If you know how clouds work, a little bit of seeding and suddenly the cloud starts raining. So it's an interreaction. Once these people are there and they say, hey, look, if I can do it, you can do it. The water's fine. Come on in. A couple more. And pretty soon you have, you know, a steady trickle. I think, and there's a lot behind this statement, but I'll just say it straightforward. I think the majority of souls here on Earth are just glad they're here and having a good time. And whatever way things flow, they'll flow with it. They're not for or against any particular way. They're just here having a good time. And if things start flowing in a certain direction, they'll go, hey, that's cool, and they'll go in that direction. And that's their choice. Having said that, it doesn't take a lot of souls to push a certain direction. A follow-up question is, trigger point of the awakening. A percentage. Oh, percentage is a very linear number. A percentage when? You know, I'm not a firm believer in linear time. And we can have a whole show on the side effects of circular time. So if somebody's going to awaken, how much do they have to awaken? You know, do they just have to recognize the divinity within? Is that all they need? Or do they need to fully awaken? I will say, in my experiences, when somebody fully awakens, it makes it very hard to do certain things anymore. There's a leavening process, tempering process, so you will, of going too far in one direction and coming back, and you're trying to be in balance. So to be aware of certain things is great, but you're still here being human, so you got to be human, and you have to enjoy that because it's a great amount of fun. So you have to balance everything and keep it all in perspective. Otherwise, people tend to wind up, in some ashram on the top of a mountain, you know, eating only organic chickpeas for the rest of their life, humming. And while this might lead their mind to certain spiritual realms, they also miss out on some of the fun parts of being human, like, you know, chocolate and sunrises and, you know, walking barefoot on the beach. So I have met people I consider true masters. And in seeing them the first time, you wouldn't consider that. But in listening to them talk about their perspectives and their way of life, you do see it. And are they always in that state? Not the ones I've met. Are they there most of the time? Yes. And it's funny because they have a certain perspective and they all have great senses of humor. I think that might be a sign is when the entire human race has a good sense of humor, then, you know, we've reached a new point.
Yeah, laughter is a way of bringing us together, isn't it? And, you know, you're right. As far as people that I have known who were very awakened, they don't take it all that seriously is the interesting thing. They're not in denial of the world, but they are able to laugh. You know, where is it did we get the idea that, for example, angels or God, however you perceive God, would not have a sense of humor? You know, we've been taught that everything has to be so serious in the higher realms, and yet I don't think it's that way. Because, part of heaven, part of paradise, however you want to label it, is laughter. So that's an interesting point.
Yeah, we talk about the other side of the veil. Love passes through the veil untouched. Do you know what the next strongest emotion that passes through the veil untouched? Humor. And people say, oh, no, they can't be. In my personal experience, divine humor is powerful, very powerful, and wickedly sophisticated. The links of the divine will go for a good joke. And, of course, usually you are the butt of the joke. But you know, if you can learn a lesson by being the butt of a good joke, is that better than having to go through a traumatic lesson? I personally have been the butt of some great divine jokes, and I always remember those lessons because they were quite funny.
Well, I know that when I first experienced an awakening, and I'm not claiming to be completely awake, the thing about awakening is it can happen in spurts. When you reach a level of higher consciousness, in that moment, you are awakened. And yet you can fall back into forgetfulness. You know, this is why when people have meditative experiences, for example, you know, they may reach a very high level for an instant or even for longer than that, but they can't maintain it. But I will tell you that when I have had those experiences, there was humor. In fact, what's really interesting about the higher realm is how everything is connected to everything, and that the humor has to do with making connections. Yes, a Kundalini experience, Brian is saying in the chat room. And it's incredibly intelligent and clever. And if you think about the way this world is set up, and people who talk about synchronicities or, you know, being in the right place at just the right time, just imagine the web that would have had to be put into place to make that happen. And as Brian said, if you get outside of linear time and you think of time as not absolute in a linear way, you can see how that could be set up to happen, even though it seems incredibly miraculous. We're getting a comment or a question. Are people's souls empty, and are they feeding off of a guru's smorgasbord of wisdom and knowledge? Well, certainly not this person. I am not a big believer in gurus. I think we're actually moving out of the age of gurus. In fact, one of the things I find so fascinating is that a lot of Christians right now, real conservative Christians, which I used to be on that path, are in tremendous anticipation and fear of an Antichrist figure, or they talk about some other leader coming to the fore. And what I find so fascinating about this awakening that I think is happening on the planet is that what's happening is not going to need a guru. That's like an old-fashioned way of being led. This is more about a collective consciousness where you're still an individual. That's the other thing that I think people get wrong, in my opinion, is if anyone watches Star Trek, it's not like the Borg. You don't lose yourself. You may lose yourself at times, but you always get yourself back. You don't, people talk about having these higher experiences where they're one with the universe. Well, that doesn't mean that you're not observing it as yourself. And I really feel that we do ourselves a disservice when we say that we have to lose ourselves. And that is a way that I am in somewhat disagreement with some pretty big figures in the metaphysical community, because some will tell you that you have to forget your personal history, and that's ego, and you have to release all of that, whereas I think the ideal spiritual experience is when you hold on to those aspects of yourself that are special about you and unite that with a divine. Because if all we're supposed to do is fall into the ocean and get lost, well, then there's just not much reason for us to exist at all. I mean, that's kind of the way I see it. And that we're here being as unique creations, and that will persist. I do believe that.
I'd like to point out that the whole concept of a guru, and I mean true guru, the traditional, for lack of a better word, Indian guru, is actually a cultural thing. It's not a universal thing. That is a particular culture in that area, that part of the world. The guru is an effective teaching technique because it's accepted, and that's just the way that culture is. In other cultures, it's not the guru so much as the person saying, show me the way, and implying there is one way. And they'll go to somebody, and they'll read the book, and they'll do the lecture, and they'll take the class, and they'll hold up the book and say, look, I found the way to spiritual enlightenment. And that's all they wanted was the way. They didn't want to do it for themselves. They want somebody to show them. It is a valid path. But in today's energy, you can basically write your own ticket. You can say, I want to do it my way. And if the divine is looking to have a human experience, what better than to have 7 billion ways of finding itself and finding higher spiritual enlightenment? Do it your way, and that's the great joy. You can do it any way you want. Any way you want to set it up, any way you want to go about it, it's your choice. And if you honor other people, you will honor their choice. If they decide that they're going to sit on the side of a mountain for 20 years and meditate and herd goats, that's their choice. if they're going to decide they're going to have a spontaneous experience at 8 years old, suddenly speak German and play the piano, that's their choice. Honor their choice and revel in how many different ways people are going to come about achieving what that which they want to achieve. I think that's where the real beauty is everybody's going to do it a slightly different way. And then people will get together and do it as a group. You'll have a group doing it here and a group doing it there. You may get a very large group. You may have a country or a race or a whole ethnic group just go poof and all make a shift together and say, look, we did it as a group. And you're going to see a lot of interesting stuff going on.
You know, when you think about the beauty of divine creativity, and, you know, all I need to do is look out the window. I mean, what if when I looked out the window, all I saw, I mean, there are some planets that are pretty uniform, you know, just this uniform landscape. Well, that's not the way our planet is. When I look out the window, I see a diversity of life in nature, and it's incredibly beautiful. And to me, that is symbolic of who we are. We are created to be special. We're created to be diverse. And if the goal of all of this is essentially to wipe us all out, wipe out that uniqueness and, you know, just go back to nothingness, I don't think that would be very satisfying even to the divine. See, I believe that we can have a relationship with the divine, you know, and I am not... you know, I did come from a conservative Christian background at one time, and so much, you know, they talk about having this personal relationship, and, you know, it's a loving relationship. Now, for me, that path didn't work for me, and I didn't have that relationship there. But I will say that I believe that there is this love out there that values each of us as unique and special. That doesn't mean that it doesn't want to draw us to that love and have us experience that love in a higher, greater way, but to lose ourselves in the process would be to destroy what was created. And, you know, of course, a single life isn't going to go on in its current form forever. I'm not going to walk this earth in this form forever, but I do believe that the aspect of me that is created here will persist. It may continue to grow and change. I believe in reincarnation. I think there are many incarnations that we go through. But it will not be lost. There is value. There is value to each of us. And, you know, just kind of bringing this back to the theme of this show, it may seem like we're going kind of far afield of the theme, are you free? But I think the way that we're answering that is, although we started with some very conventional ways of looking at are we free within our society, within the workplace, different ways of looking at it, at least for Brian and myself and for many other people, no matter what path it is that they have chosen, true freedom is to be found within the realm of consciousness. And one's spiritual path is important. Now, I will say there are atheists and agnostics I have talked to. Some are very angry and reacting, and, you know, I feel a lot of wounds with those people. But certainly having read some of these books, you know, I think it was, I think it was maybe Dawson who said, you know, he found a type of spirituality just in pondering the universe, just in pondering the beauty of the intricacy of the universe. And for him, that brought him to a higher experience. I mean, that's what I read as I was reading his book. And to me, he's having a spiritual experience in his own way. He's just been taught, and it's been labeled that to have one, you have to have it a certain way. And certainly there are dogmas within our society that say you must believe this way or you're not going to experience God. Well, I think there is tremendous beauty in realizing that, yes, atheists are experiencing the divine without even knowing it. Because how could they not experience it? That divine is omnipresent. And if that's the way, if for that particular atheist, if that's what it takes to ponder the intricacies of the universe, if that is what takes him to that higher place, then that's wonderful. It works for him. Now, what I would hope is that he wouldn't take away alternative experiences for everyone else. Now, that's a problem in that, you know, there are too many people in the world trying to do that. Now, many of us, even on this show, we will question things on our own path. We will say things that we felt caused wounds within our own path. And I think it's okay to be honest about that. But I do think that we need to find some common ground in this world. And as our consciousness expands, more and more the commonalities between us will become more apparent.
Excuse me, I was looking at some more research.
That's all right. I'm just taking a breath here. It's a fairly casual show here.
The more I prepare, the less I get to use it. So I try only to prepare certain things, footnotes. Every time I lay out long notes, we never get to it. So this is the universe telling me to not try to overplan it. It's funny.
We're just here having a conversation.
I do speaking engagements. If I lay it out to the letter, first thing that happens is we get sidetracked and never go back to my notes. So I was just checking out something else. We've already covered that, so I don't need to cover that again.
So we may be winding down here. I mean, if we run out of things to say, I'm not going to keep the show going. As I said when we started this, we'll go as long as it makes sense. We're establishing this show. I don't know if we'll be here every single week. We've seen some return audience this week on Saturday night. This show has aired at different times. I've had it on Friday. At times, there will be other guests. I view Brian as really a co-host of sorts who comes on occasion. And, you know, we've joked about having the Susan and Brian Saturday nights, and he didn't want to call it Brian and Susan because that would be BS, right? Is that the...
That's the line, is the Susan and Brian show, because if it was Brian and Susan, it would just be BS. Or something about that.
In a sense, you know, we're just here talking. I mean, this is a casual, relaxed conversation. So I think we've kind of drawn this to a close for now. And, you know, unless you have something more of your wisdom to share, Brian?
Nope, I'm feeling that's pretty much it for tonight. We didn't have a real specific topic. Probably one night we'll do something really specific and see how fuzzy woo-woo we can take it. Just for the fun.
Yeah, so I'm sure we can come up with any number of things. And all we're doing is taking conversations that he and I have had, and, you know, just between us, we're taking them to more people. That's our intent with this show, and also sharing, letting others share in the conversation as well. So I want to thank everyone for being here tonight in the chat room and anyone who has called. And we look forward to sharing this space with you again. Just keep an eye on the show schedule. I always publish them at least a day in advance. I'm trying to get to maybe a couple days. We're pretty spontaneous with this show. And we do appreciate the listeners who are listening in the archive. We very much feel your energy. As people who don't really believe we're bounded by time, we believe that people listening in the future are here with us as well, within the energy of this show. And I do appreciate that. So if I could leave you with anything this week is, you know, discover those moments of freedom just within your own consciousness, no matter what is going on in your life. I mean, to me, that's what has helped me through my own fears. So have a great night, everyone.
Good night, everyone. Thanks for being with us.